Hey, welcome to Noise in the Megacity. Today, an interview with Jessica Thompson, a media artist working in sound, performance, and mobile technology. Much of her work involves organizing sound walks, other outdoor listening events, and the use of small electronics and cell phones to track, archive, and otherwise activate urban space. And if you're curious about Jessica's work or any of the projects she mentions in the interview, the show page for Noise in the Megacity will have all of the links. So, on with the show. Starting at the beginning, your undergrad is in visual arts and painting?
It is, yeah. So I graduated from York University, which is in the northern part of Toronto, in 1998, with a studio degree in painting and sculpture, with a bunch of art history and English kind of in there as well. And then I think that how I ended up getting to sound was sort of through obsessions around space. And this idea of, I think it actually came out of a combination between my painting practice and my sculptural practice. And this is probably not going to be very interesting for the audience, but I'll just sort of say it anyway, so you know what I'm talking about. But when I was a painter, I was focusing on abstraction, and I was thinking about the idea of not necessarily sort of what I was painting. Imagery was disappearing from my paintings, and they ended up sort of becoming these seas of brushstrokes made with oil, so they had this sort of mark of gesture. And I was thinking about the idea of painting being, of all paintings, kind of containing the story of their own making. You can't just snap your fingers and say painting, and lo and behold, you have a painting. Mm-hmm. You have to actually be there with it and have it unfold over space and time. And so I was thinking about the parallels between mark making and mapping, mm-hmm. and starting to think about cartography. At the same time, I had a wonderful sculpture teacher named Ted Beeler, who I think is still going. He was great. He would just, you'd come in with questions and he'd sit there and talk to you about Zen Buddhism. It was kind of amazing. And I was doing this thing where I was going into various public spaces and I was using chalk lines, like, you know, Home Depot chalk lines, like you're trying to mark a level line and it's like, you know, it's powdery stuff. Yeah. And I started sort of making these lines in various places. And in Toronto, it was a neighborhood where my dad grew up. My dad grew up in downtown Toronto. And so I was kind of interested in making line drawings in that space as a way of kind of marking place. Mm-hmm. And also I was starting to think about the idea of moving through space. And the sort of shift that occurs en route when you move through space. So my foray into media art started after I did something called an independent studio program at the Toronto School of Art. I'm not sure whether that still exists or whether it exists in the same form. But when I was there with some really great other people, and I got to take a bunch of classes, and I was sort of engaging in unintentional turned intentional walking practice. So my first sound piece technically happened in 99. I was doing a bunch of things with just sort of these very barren shots of Lake Ontario that were just basically just lines, like gray into white. And I was experimenting with slide projections. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about sort of mechanics of photography. And so what this piece was, and this is not on my website, I don't think I've talked about this in an interview before, so you're hearing it first. but this piece, exclusive, now, yes, just wait. I had this projection of the lake, and it was a slide projection again because we didn't have digital projectors, and it came up from the floor. And I wanted to create this idea of a reference to sort of mechanical quality of photography. And of course, these slide projectors are kind of like, you know, they're loud and kind of hummy and rattly. And so I started experimenting with putting contact mics into the projector, which would make this sort of weird rattle hum. Mm-hmm. So that was my first, I guess, sound installation. And then from there, I started thinking about, I was going on walks between my studio at the Toronto School of Art, so going to there from my workplace. And my workplace was a triple threat musical theater school in downtown Toronto. And so I had this sort of secretarial slash admissions job, and I was sort of walking as a way of decompressing because I love musical theater, but to young performers, everything is an emergency and it's a lot. And so I was decompressing and sort of walking and thinking about this this shift that occurs en route where you know where you start and you know where you end, but there's these moments where you're superseding geography. Again, this is before cell phones were common and certainly before GPS was in cell phones. So it doesn't make any sense now, but at the time it made sense. And the way that I was trying to think about this was I was doing these audio recordings of my route. And I didn't know anything about recording technologies. I had a tape recorder that you would bring to your art history lectures, because if you didn't get it in the moment, there was no sort of getting the slides afterwards or anything. Any of the nice things we do for our students now, you kind of had to see it, remember it, and then be ready for the exam. So we'd often tape our lectures. And so I had this terrible tape player and tape recorder, and I was walking with this tape recorder. And so, of course, you get like all this staticky wind and you, but more importantly, A, they were terrible recordings, and B, they were so tied into place. I would remember, and of course with Toronto, for those not familiar, it's one of the cities that still has streetcars and they have a very specific sound. And so, you know, you walk from one downtown to the other, you're going to hear a streetcar. And so I'd be able to hear the streetcar and think, okay, that's where I walked over Dundas Street. I'd remember in the recordings, you know, when the cute little girl passed me giggling. I'd remember all these spaces. And I was thinking that, you know, it was just too tied into place. And I thought, you know, I was interested in the space between spaces, because to me the space between spaces is still a space, and the place between places is still a place. And so what I thought is, if there was a way of just amplifying, like, because I was recording, but I was also trying to capture my footsteps. I was holding the recorder downwards, and of course you hear your footsteps, but you also hear everything else. And so I was like, I thought to myself, you know, if there's a way of amplifying the footsteps, then you'd have the piece. And so that's where the walking machine started.
And that piece came about in about 2010, or am I thinking of a different piece?
2003.
2003. Okay, so this is early in your sound practice.
It was very, very early. That's generally the first piece I talk about. And when I'm asked, I usually say I've been making sound work since 2003, because the first piece, I rarely talk about it. And it's also so different from my other work in that it deals with space inside a gallery rather than being outside.
Yeah.
And the reality is, I mean, Walking Machine was started way earlier. But I was struggling with how to solder things together. And I had all these sort of weird amplifiers, and I couldn't amplify the sound cleanly. I couldn't quite figure out what to do as far as mics go. So 2003 was the year that I finished it in its current form. But the reality was that it started earlier.
I definitely want to return to specific pieces, but I think in the context of this show, it may be a nice organizing principle to kind of give some framing questions, because this show, I think described it kind of briefly, is about noise in many different incarnations, and specifically how we choose or don't choose to listen to it.
Right.
I spent this year trying to figure out what is the noise of a megacity, because it seems almost that every single year I see a major publication write a story about how cities are becoming more noisy in this very kind of like almost alarmist rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's not a companion piece, which I wish was written, about how we don't listen as much anymore, or how some people have figured out a way to exist within the noise, I think just the incredible amount of data that is bombarding us, and we just have to figure out ways to filter it out, right?
Right, right.
And in discussions of like listening and sound practice, I think there's often something that's left out, that it's a protective mechanism, that
right, absolutely.
The not listening. It's not simply a lack of mindfulness. Sometimes it comes across that way, mm-hmm. but I think we protect ourselves by only receiving certain data, because otherwise absolutely. We would be totally, totally just overwhelmed. I know I am.
Yeah, I mean, you don't exactly have a field of vision, right? And you know, it's, I think it was Schaefer who said the idea that we don't have any ear lids.
Yeah.
And so we can't possibly, we would be instantly overwhelmed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the process of a sound walk, in any sound walk, there is perhaps a proposition that for right now, for this period of time, let's see what we are filtering out. Let's try to listen to everything to get the, mm-hmm. and see what happens. And I was watching, I think, one of the documentation videos of Borderline. And I like how in the bottom, it says the little tag of a sound, like the collar of a dog or the flagpole yeah. waving. And then you get the GPS mark numbers. when you approach making a sound walk, if someone says, we would like you to do a sound walk, what is the beginning of that process? Do you start with walking and at a certain time, at a certain place?
Mm-hmm.
What is your approach to a sound walk?
It depends on, that's a good question. It depends on whether it is, I can tell you what I've historically done, and I can tell you what I currently do. Okay. So historically, I do exactly what you said. I tend to sort of walk an area. I try to make a decision about whether this is going to be a sound walk that I lead, or a sound walk that that people can just, you know, lead themselves, or we rotate and have different people lead. And I try to go around the time that it is scheduled, to sort of get a better sense of what might be there. I also try to, and this might just be because I've done so many sound walks in Toronto, and we have this network of alleyways behind buildings and around. So you can kind of navigate a lot through a lot of the city just by ducking down alleys. And so I often try to balance being on the street with being in and out of these alleys. Mm. I try to make a decision about whether I want to have a blindfolded portion of the sound walk, which Hildegard Westerkamp would do a lot as well, of just, and if so, then I do actually want to have a busier area, because I think that experience of walking down a very busy route, being led by your elbow while blindfolded, is remarkable. Mm-hmm. So that's what I typically do if I'm just asked to lead a sound walk in general. And I do something similar, I think, when I lead sound walks with the walking machine as well. With the walking machine, it is more of figuring out a route and then just letting people explore, but also watching them. Because with the walking machine, where you are amplifying the sound for your footsteps in real time, your sense of where sound is coming from is thrown off just ever so slightly. Mm-hmm. So you can be having a perfectly good time and not quite realize that there is an oncoming car as close as they are. So when I'm leading, I'm making air quotes for your listeners, people on sound walks with the walking machine, often what I'm doing is actually just spotting, just to make sure everyone is able to enjoy the work, but also I'm the one kind of watch. I'm the mother hen watching for traffic and other people, etc. For Borderline, which is this, which you mentioned earlier, which is this project that looks at the relationship between sound and data in cities, to see if sound can teach us something about how cities are changing. I actually look at the data. So what I do is with this piece, which is in beta right now, we don't quite have it on the App Store yet because I keep on adding things and making changes, hashtag artist. But with this piece, you're actually able to see urban data and follow it and then annotate sound in real time. You can either do it through a notebook layer, or you can actually, there's embedded neural networks in the app where you can actually just tap a little ear and it will try to identify sound for you, and then you can correct it if it's wrong, and it also makes a recording which can be played back in the space. To plan these walks, what I'll do is I'll look for densities of urban data. Mm-hmm. And depending on where I am, I'll try to figure out what to follow. That piece in particular came from just me wondering what gentrification sounded like. What does change in cities, particularly gentrification, sound like? And it started with a sound walk through gentrification I was invited to lead by Amish Morrell, who was the editor of C Magazine, and that was in 2014. And so we went on this sound walk through gentrification, and it followed the structure that I mentioned earlier. We sort of ducked in and out of alleys. We had a blindfolded portion. There was a very, very bad summer storm, so we kind of got soaked and ducked into a dollar store, and all sorts of things happened on the sound walk. But, you know, what struck me about that walk was how quiet that neighborhood was at certain points of the day. It's a part of Toronto that is rapidly changing. However, you know, with that sort of, with gentrification in cities, you often end up with sort of a monoculture. And so in that particular neighborhood, everyone was at work at the same time, you know, so it came alive at night because everyone was pretty much at the same age and same stage, which I found really interesting. And I began to wonder if there was a way of mapping sound better, could we actually interface that with other forms of urban data? So to actually answer your question, I'm sorry, I'm segueing so much. When I do borderline as a sound walk, I'll often look at Airbnb data.
I was going to ask about Airbnbs, yes. And certainly the connection to gentrification is quite...
Oh my goodness, yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think that, you know, this is a source of data which is a little bit fragile because depending on local ordinances around Airbnbs, like if a city basically says that you can't buy up properties to rent out as Airbnbs anymore, then we're going to see a change in this data set. But for now, it's really compelling. In Toronto especially, we have lots of new developments where you barely have any occupants because people are buying them in order to rent them out on Airbnb, because you can make way more money renting out a unit as an Airbnb than you ever will having a renter. And this is creating uneven geographies in scores of cities. I know that in New York, you have Fairbnb and Inside Airbnb as well, some great organizations. And also you're creating rent gaps. It really is impacting public space in cities. And so if you pull the data for a place like Toronto, you can see these just clusters that line up with our condo towers. Toronto is a city that has been very late to develop its waterfront. The waterfront was very, very industrial until the 2000s. And so what you have is all these new condo developments in areas that were essentially lake, actually. The original waterline for Lake Ontario goes up to King Street. So it's basically we built into the lake. And you'll just see these clusters of single home, whole home Airbnbs. So if you go to Airbnb and you want to check off that you want an entire apartment to yourself, you'll see these areas. And so because that data clusters so nicely and because it's so compelling, I really love leading sound walks where you can actually go and sort of experience those areas, because we don't really think about it when we're experiencing a city from day to day.
Mm-hmm. Kind of jumping off of that very last point of what we don't experience on a day-to-day. Mm-hmm. Something that I often think about on the sound walk is that you're moving through space,
yeah,
as opposed to standing in one place and getting the sound as it changes throughout the day. There's a, yes, sort of, you almost take out some element of the time and the change that we can't see in a 1 hour sound walk.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I find your work and its interaction with GIS and other like map essentially mapping and archiving mm-hmm. projects, it makes something a little bit more visual that we can't often perceive of, because it functions in time and place, two things that we don't have sensory organs for.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think of the mapping aspect of Borderline, for instance? Mm-hmm. What I understand the creation or the use and then creation of new data sets.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the question is, to what ends?
I think that, to what end? That's a great question. I think for me, having a way of marking sound in place and a way of generating sonic data that goes not only beyond the confines of the sound walk, but also the confines of the sound map. Sound maps are beautiful, but they are completely imperfect, right? You know, it's really, not only are you dealing with the bias of the map maker, you're also dealing with the place and time. It's also really difficult to map sound. You know, we've known this since Murray Schafer wrote The Tuning of the World in 73, I think. So if I'm interested in the idea, I think if we are to figure out how sound impacts cities, we have to actually engage in sonic research using any means necessary. I think that some things that cities are doing, and I know that out of NYU in New York, they did a huge, massive research project that resulted in the Urban 8K data set, which involved placing microphones around different neighborhoods and being able to actually just have them on. Ryerson University in Toronto worked with the City of Toronto to actually place urban microphones to figure out their sound ordinances, because the bylaws around sound were done prior to many downtown neighborhoods gentrifying, and they needed to completely rewrite it and realize that, you know, districts which were at one time quiet were loud and vice versa. So I think that that's a really great form of research. I think, though, that what's missing with that is our personal experiences of sound. And I think that sound is a social medium. I'm very much in Brandon LaBelle's school around the idea of sound as primarily a relational medium. And I think that the personal experience of sound is something that is missing. And we can capture that with traditional modes of sound walking and sound mapping. But until we're actually able to interface that with other forms of data, I think that we need to actually just bring our personal experience of sound into the wider world. I think that that's a valid form of data. Mm-hmm. I think that if enough people do it, it becomes a really good source of information. Because also how we think of sound is socially and culturally situated as well. So I just want to check in and make sure I'm answering your question.
Absolutely.
Am I hitting it? Okay. Okay. I just think it's good to check. And I think that also too, that, you know, it's something where, the purpose of mapping sound is to look at, the idea of the impact of sound on how people experience space. And so we can't experience sound in isolation. I think Tom Ingold's Against Soundscape comes into mind here with this idea that we can't necessarily separate the experience of sound from what we see visually, what we experience in terms of space, how we feel in a place, etc. So I think that the more data that we're able to gather and the more people who are able to contribute data, the better picture we have of the relationship between sound and cities and how cities can reveal themselves through sound.
The relational aspect of sound is something that I think about quite a bit, especially when it comes to noise, because it is essentially a subjective definition.
Mm-hmm.
It is sound that we feel some sort of way about. And with it, that simply by defining something as noise personally, we kind of explode some, I think, often deeply held relational power dynamics, especially. Mm-hmm. I saw, and I've been trying to now find this piece again, but recently I saw a map of New York City noise complaints, basically a heat map. And you really see that the data hotspots are around the borders between rich and poor neighborhoods, and I think quite a bit more interestingly, in rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now my own conjecture, but I don't think the sound of those neighborhoods is changing very much. But the relation to the sound that has been there is mm-hmm. changing as this often whiter, richer
mm-hmm.
group of people are moving in with their own set of ownership and also expectation of whatever they think silence is.
Yes.
And I think it very much resonates with this idea of relational sound, that it is always absolutely. In place and in community or lack thereof that we listen.
No, absolutely. I've done something similar. I took, whose was it? There was a geographer who mapped noise complaints to 2015. Let me find this as I'm talking to you because technology. But he basically went through and mapped all the sound complaints in New York City. And he said that most of the sound complaints are around music or loud parties. Mm. What I was doing, see if I can quickly find this for you. And I did not make that heat map. Whoever did, that is awesome.
Yeah.
I want to make one too. What I had done was I actually went and I had mapped his data. I had pulled all the noise complaints from New York. And it's a massive data set. Like if you do just clear everything off your computer,
you might have enough space
oh, to download God. It all. God. So basically what I did was where is it?
Yeah, you're welcome to take a moment to look for it. You don't have to also talk.
Miracle recording, right? I mean, there's Brendan Farrell's How Loud, and that is an online mapping application that uses like vehicle traffic, air traffic, and then proximity to things like restaurants and schools to create what he calls a sound score, which is kind of like a walk score for sound. Mm-hmm. I think it started as an open, just a project, and now it's actually resulted into something that has a lot of value with real estate. So people are using that as a way to figure out where to move. And I think the project actually started when he was trying to find a new neighborhood to move into, and he wanted a quiet neighborhood, so he got the idea for the project.
As I was traveling through Bangkok, which was one of my project cities in this Noise in the Megacity fellowship that I received, mm-hmm. I noticed I was looking at real estate ads, and Bangkok, like many megacities, has all of these massive high rises going up at the moment, but mm-hmm. in neighborhoods where most of the buildings for the last 50 years have been 2 to 3 stories. And all of the advertisements, or at least one consistent theme, was about literally rising above the noise of the city.
Yes.
The funny thing is that it actually is they're selling a false dream, because the sound goes straight up anyway.
And they're the noisemakers. I mean, it's this idea of like, isn't it interesting how the idea of silence sort of, we've gone from the idea of silence and quiet is something that is aligned with systems of power, and it's something to see, it's something that we should be paying for, it's been commodified. I found the data set I was going to mention. So in 2015, Ben Wellington, a geographer, created a series of noise maps using municipal noise complaints in New York City. And then he published a paper. It wasn't a heat map, though, so I think someone else has probably done it. But what I did with his data was I didn't use his data. What I did was I actually just replicated his maps. I pulled down the same data set. And what I did was I looked at last year, and I mapped out all the locations of noise complaints that were loud music or parties. Again, for your audience, I'm making air quotes here. And then what I did was I overlaid that with Airbnb data. And those clusters are pretty, much on. I think that totally supports what you were saying around this idea of it's not necessarily that the neighborhoods are getting noisier. It's just the people more likely to make noise complaints are moving into cities and experiencing sounds that they consider noise, right? Mm-hmm. It's so closely aligned with systems of power. I think that is also the logic in encouraging white folks to, if you're going to call the police in a black neighborhood, to sort of make sure you understand what you are calling for, because there can sometimes be problems when police show up, and when the police show up, it's different depending on who you are.
Certainly, and it very quickly goes beyond noise. So, yeah. I have kind of a tendency of buying any book with noise in the title. One interesting one is titled Black Noise, and it's actually mostly about hip hop and hip hop culture. But also very much how it's been received. Yes. And it is, I think, not insignificant that often many ethnic minorities, one of the stereotypes that is applied to, let's say, black people in the United States is that they are noisy, like
yes.
the loud black person.
Yes.
And there's two things I think that go on there. It's one, treating noise, if we think of noise as a sort of sonic trash, like that it has no value. I think mm-hmm. it is a kind of dog whistle of like, you're actually kind of saying that some part of this person has no value.
Right.
But also that when they make noise or when they make sound, it is noise. Like, their sound is inherently less valuable, or at least is certainly not in relation to you, the presumed omniscient, unbiased observer who is often presented as the white male researcher, because they somehow have this view that, you know, you have no biases.
Right. It's the purity of the medium. I'm fairly racially ambiguous in terms of how I look, but I'm biracial, and so we are African American and Jewish. And I know from just growing up and having a dad who grew up in downtown Toronto during the civil rights era, during a time where Toronto was not that diverse, there's a lot of inherent behaviors that we grew up with around the idea of respectability politics and showing up in place and having to function in white spaces. And one of the things is not shooting off your mouth. And I find also as an academic, I'm often brought into or starting conversations around race in the academy. And I always sort of have this thought in the back of my mind of like, at what point do I become just an angry black woman? Mm-hmm. Or to them, maybe an angry, racially ambiguous woman. So much of what you're saying resonates with me around this idea of the construction of the listening ear as essentially an instrument of white supremacy. I'm also reading Jennifer Stover's The Sonic Color Line.
Oh, I've been really looking forward
it's
to reading
so
it.
Good. Oh, my goodness. She's not that far from you. She's at SUNY. Where is she? Is she in Troy? She's in the SUNY system somewhere. She is awesome. This is a white scholar writing about whiteness. It is really interesting. It talks about the idea of how we construct the idea of noise as, or how the idea of noise kind of functions within the realm of white supremacy. And also, again, this idea that, by saying something is noise, you're saying it's something that's unwanted. You're saying it's something that is invalid. It assumes that a neutrality of the medium, which is actually just a white construction. True, I was reading Black Noise too, because I'm writing a really short piece on the role of the boombox in Do the Right Thing, which I'm having so much fun with. Oh my God. And so
I'll have to read that.
Yes.
Please send it along.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting because one of the things I'm looking at is the idea of so much of hip hop at the time was recorded in a way that completely ignored conventions around recording, and the idea that, the goal of a good recording is to have this clean, beautiful thing. I mean, you and I are both recording our ends of this conversation, and if we've done it right, it should sound like we're pretty much in the same room. If one of us has done it wrong or there's hum, that means there's something else there and there's been a mistake. Whereas, you know, with hip hop musicians, they deliberately recorded in a way that they worked in the red specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of booming, thunderous sound, the idea of using, there's a particular drum machine that was used that is sort of bassy, but also kind of rough sounding as well. Mm-hmm.
And then within,
it's not the 808. Again, I'll look it up for you. But it's basically, but also too, when in that film, the idea of, you know, all these moments of racial tension function around that boombox, the climax of the film. And I'm not spoiling it because it's like 20 years old now. Is you know, the Radio Raheem's death around because he hasn't turned off his boombox. They worked on the EMU SP1200, which is a 12-bit sound machine, and there was this just sort of gritty sounding distortion that was on it. I'm having so much fun. It's one of those things where you go on a track and you realize you're not quite writing what you've been asked to write, but I'm just like, I'm having so much fun. Maybe it'll just happen. And again, this idea of, you know, who has a right to say what is noise? Noise is really just the sound that we personally don't want. What is joyful to some is annoying to others. You know, it's culturally situated. I learned this the hard way earlier on in my life when I was homesick for a week. I had a very bad cold. I had the type of cold that knocks out your vocal cords, one of those where you're just literally in bed. And I rented an apartment across from a public school, an elementary school. And they had these mechanical bells, which would go off like, you know, every day to go into school and then recess and then come in from recess and then go out for lunch. And, you know, it's like six times a day. And I knew from being around on weekends that the bells would also go on weekends. And I always thought it was weird. And one day when I was kind of feeling better, I was home during weekday, and I decided to kind of like toddle over and kind of march in and ask them if they knew that they left these bells on, because I couldn't imagine anyone doing it intentionally. And so I walk in the school office, and I'm like, you know, my late 20s, I walk in and I'm like, hi, you know, I live across the street from you. And I wonder if do you know that you leave your bells on the weekend? And they look at me and say, oh yeah, of course, because, you know, if we turn them off, then they get thrown off in terms of time, and then they're not accurate. And then, like, they go off, they don't go off exactly on time or something. I don't know. And I said, well, you know, it disturbs everybody in the neighborhood because your bells start at, like, you know, 8:15 in the morning. And I said, you know, have you considered maybe just turning them off and just trying to reset them properly? And they just looked at me like I was crazy. And told me, no, you know, you, and basically they explained that the wrath of the parents, if your bell is off, is something that you don't want to deal with. And that was more important than all of us who lived in the neighborhood. And I looked at them like they were crazy, and they looked at me like I was crazy, because I must not understand how children work. And it was just this, like, it was just this moment of, like, complete disconnect where, you know, they felt perfectly comfortable sort of wielding that power over us in the neighborhood, because the children and the and especially the parents were more afraid of the parents than they were of, you know, little old me. So that's how that worked out. So, yeah,
the sound wasn't exactly for you, and also you didn't have the power in that situation.
And also I was not important there. And that's a really, you know, crappy feeling. I think too that, you know, when we experience sound, like walking, I'm thinking about your early question around sound walking. And, you know, when we, it's not, the great thing about noise complaint data is, you know, it's made from the home, right? Rarely, if you're walking past something and you walk past something really, really loud, you're not going to lodge a noise complaint against it because you've walked through it. you're not there, you don't live there. Whereas, you know, when sound hits home, we get really, really emotional about it. And we are willing to tolerate all sorts of, you know, what we think of as noise or loudness or whatever it is when it's outside your home. But when it's at home, especially if you've moved into a brand new neighborhood and you've paid a lot of money for your place and you are there and like you've got these neighbors who play music late and, you know, it's this weird sort of wielding of power. And, you know, it feels unfair and really strange, but it generates really fascinating data.
That is a really excellent observation, because I hadn't thought of that of course you would only make your noise complaint from home, or the vast majority of it. There's a certain expectation that we should have some amount of quiet in the home.
Yes.
Although, yes, as you live in apartments, that becomes less and less the expectation. But and then the sounds of, let's say, the neighbors above you walking.
Oh, yeah.
At first, I've noticed, I mean, if it is more or less consistent, mm-hmm, eventually it fades into the background.
Mm-hmm.
As with friends of mine who live near train tracks, they, yes, don't hear the train anymore.
Yeah.
But it is actually the sound of disturbance that is the thing that is out of sorts, or at least out of sorts in whatever conception you have of the sound world.
Mm-hmm.
That's the disturbance.
Yeah, it depends. It depends. I grew up near train tracks and never heard the train. I didn't realize the train came late until I had a girl my own age move next door, and she was just like, "How do you sleep with the trains?" And I'm like, "What trains?" But you know, it also too depends on, I forget, you know, it's like misremembering scholars, but apparently if the sound is something that you know, or you're welcome, or you're used to, we're more accepting of it. So with your neighbors who were upstairs from you, I think it would probably make a difference if you knew your neighbors. Same if you live next to, you know, a dog who barks either because they're by themselves or someone's coming home or whatever it is. You know, if you know and like the dog, you have an entirely different attitude towards them barking as like, "Oh my God, it's that dog." You know, I have a cat who yells at 6:30 every morning, and I'm always thinking of my downstairs neighbor, and I'm like, "Oh my goodness, it's like this, like, you know, it's this cat yelling directly above her bedroom." So far, I haven't heard anything, which is good. Crossing fingers, but you know, I think about that, this idea of like, you know, if you know what the sound is, you're more accepting of it. Or also, if it's the sound you've signed on for. You know, if you've moved to the city with the idea that you want to be around people and you want to be part of a place that's busy and bustling, then I think a certain amount of that busyness and bustling is kind of okay with you because that's what you signed up for. I think where it becomes interesting is when people move into spaces which have those conditions because that's where they are, and yet they get upset with the sound. You know, it's kind of interesting, right? Like,
it's not what I signed up for.
I thought it was what I wanted, but now I don't want it anymore. And I'm angry. You know, it's yeah.
Yeah, that certainly applies to Bushwick.
Oh yeah. Oh my goodness. Oh, that's right. Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah.
If you'll indulge me in a little bit of kind of conjecture or future looking, is there a way in which people should listen to the city? There some aspect of your work which is almost trying to bring forth a way of listening? Or is it an observation of how things are?
Huh, that's a really good question. I think with a lot of my work, they do function as framing devices. around listening or making sound in this or being the noisemaker in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I consider though that my audience or users have a lot of agency in how they use the work, either where they use it or how they use it. And they have a lot of choice in how they have a lot of choice as well. So I try to make these pieces fairly open-ended and frame it just enough so that it, just enough that it enables you to play or to explore or to create that state, but then also open enough that you can find a way of having your own experience with it. And I'm notorious for not recording because I feel like what happens between you and one of my projects is really, that's your thing. Like it's not my thing. I made it. I decided what it was going to sort of be or where it was going to start. That's your thing. So I always love hearing stories about my projects because I don't consider my artworks to actually be artworks until they're being used. And so I don't get to spend a lot of time like sort of contemplating my objects that I've made because it just looks like a pile of wires and stuff. And so I always love it when people tell me stories about what happened when they used the work. Though to better answer your question, you were asking me about the idea of how should we listen in space? And I think that, you know, you can listen in space however you want. As long as you acknowledge that your way is not the only way. There's more than one form of right? And so with myself, my mission is to try to, with at least my current research, is to sort of map out sound in a way that reveals change and hopefully is a way of actually mapping inequality or drawing our attention to that stuff. That's my deal. But I think that with anyone else, like however you do it is fine, as long as it feels authentic to what you need to do. And also as long as you kind of acknowledge that, you know, we are all art comes from privilege, right? Whether it is financial privilege or whether it is intellectual privilege, whatever it is, you know, if you've decided that you're going to make something in the world that comes from a certain place of privilege. So as long as we sort of acknowledge that one way or another, we are actually engaging in something that does involve privilege, I think that we'll probably all be okay.
Thank you. That was a very lovely summation of some ideas that I feel like were bubbling throughout the interview.
Oh, thank you.
The space between spaces is something which clearly functions in the Borderline piece,
mm-hmm.
and kind of resonates throughout the rest of your work.
Mm-hmm.
You said that they too are spaces. There's a kind of like we should be mindful of those spaces as not just transitionary, but as themselves. Mm-hmm. Something to listen to or to be, I don't know, mindful of perhaps. This is a very large question, which feel free to answer as glibly as you like, but what is the relationship between sound and space making or space more generally? Or what are some themes that kind of tend to bubble up to the surface when that question kind of presents itself to you?
What's the relationship between sound and space making? Yeah. I'm not very good at being glib on my feet, so I'm going to try to actually answer the question. Let's see. I think that, you know, sound has the capacity to completely change your experience of space. Like it has the capacity to infuse space with meaning, which may or may not work for you. It's a way of asserting dominance over a space. We're comfortable making sound in space in the spaces we feel comfortable. If we are in a space that's unfamiliar to us, we're very quiet, right? So if we feel comfortable walking down the street with a boombox or, you know, yelling with our friends at 1 a.m. or whatever it is. It's a way of sort of asserting comfort, but also power. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I think that it is interesting because sound travels through space, but again, all sound has a source somewhere and there's something making the sound. Mm-hmm. And that's usually in a place somewhere, either it's moving through or it's in a space. I think that, you know, it's inherently political. It's inherently social. To jump to your previous question, you said earlier, before you asked your question, about the idea of, the space between spaces being a place and the place between places being a place. And, you know, to me, I've never seen it any other way. That might be because I'm a biracial person. It might just be just how I entered sound. I entered it through visual arts. So there's all sorts of rules that I just either didn't know about or chose to ignore. But I think that too, that just because something isn't articulated in place doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. I think about this a lot when I think about Black geographies within cities, because those are geographies of erasure. Because so much of how we think about cities is tied into property ownership and being able to stake a claim over space. So if you're denied the ability to do that, you float through these spaces. And just because it is difficult to pin down what is happening to a community or what's happening over time does not mean that wasn't happening. It doesn't mean it wasn't real. Right. And so I'd have a tendency to encourage everybody to ignore parameters because, you know, if you're only looking at data that is available through open data sets through your city, you really are trusting those people who've gathered that data and compiled it for you. You're really trusting those people who generated that data. You're really trusting decision makers who are far outside you. I've learned so much about this from Mimi Onuha, who does work around missing data sets. And for those not familiar, definitely look her up. You know, she talks about missing data sets all the time and the idea of looking at cities not only through the data that is there, but what ought to be there. Just as we were actually testing our equipment and we were just sort of chattering about something, you were mentioning about the idea of people thinking about noise in cities and trying to escape noise in cities and cities trying to sort of solve their sound problems. And I think that it's not as simple as that. We make noise every day. It is completely fluid and mutable. Cities change in multiple dimensions. And I think that sound is a big part of that. And it is unwieldy and difficult to pin down. So we need multiple ways of understanding sound. I'm building one tool. We need many tools. We need many new forms of research. And I think that I think sonic research is so interesting and people who are working in sound studies are so interesting because there's just this openness that we have to try new things because we know that our methods are imperfect.
Oh, yeah.
and that we have to engage in multiple sort of a weird multidisciplinary exploratory approach in order to answer our questions. And I think that sound artists and sound researchers have this wonderful openness that I've always really appreciated. When I first started making artwork with sound, I felt really nervous about engaging with other sound artists because I felt like I wasn't a musician. You know, I felt like I was a bit of a hack. I was early in my career, and I found such a welcoming, inclusive, enthusiastic space. And I think those of us who are working in mobile sound, those of us who still explore ideas around psychogeography, there's this sort of openness to adventure that is really wonderful.
As a way to bring to an end a conversation about noise, I think I should ask a question about silence.
Okay.
Namely, is there such thing as silence?
No.
You're like, no, period.
No, Cage. No. I think, you know, it's there such thing as silence? I mean, if we think about silence scientifically, then no, Cage was right. If we think about silence as something that is culturally situated, commodified, like it depends on how you define silence. If we think about silence as purely the absence of sound, then probably not. If we think about silence as a social construction, then maybe. I think that how we think of silence is as interesting as the ways that we think about noise.
Thank you so much for making the time to talk with me. I know we definitely went way longer than I said we would, but I really appreciate it. It was so lovely to talk to you. And I look forward to using Borderline in its full form.
Absolutely. I really have to stop making little interface changes, but it should be ready later on this year or early next year. But if you want a beta version, I'll send you a link so you can play around. But yeah, thank you for this conversation as well. It's your interests sound really great. I love how you think about sound in the city. And yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks to Jessica Thompson for our wide-ranging discussion of noise, which was recorded in late November of 2019. Her sound recording and mapping project, Borderline, will hit the App Store soon, and you can find more info on her website, jessicathompson.ca. Till next month, take care.